Hello and welcome to The Interior Design Business, the monthly podcast produced by the interior design community for the interior design community. My name is Jeff Hayward, and today with my co-host, Susie Rumbold, Creative Director of Tessuto Interiors, we're exploring healthy spaces, happy places, and how to integrate wellness into the design process.
Wellness is defined as the state of being in good health, especially as an actively pursued goal. But as everyone knows, wellness is more than just physical health. For some time, this buzzword has been permeating discussions around all aspects of modern existence, and even more so since the recent pandemic. People are consciously striving to improve their well-being and increase their happiness and quality of life. Interior designers have always understood that well-ordered functional spaces can relieve anxiety and bring relaxation and peace, but today's well-informed clients are now demanding enhanced wellness as requisite for their interior spaces. So, what exactly constitutes well-being, and how can we achieve this elusive goal? And what should interior designers do to keep pace with the latest thinking on wellness and apply that theory in their work? Welcome to the Interior Design Business.
Today we are joined by Karen Stoneley and Peter Pelsinski, co-founders and creative forces behind Span Architecture, the internationally renowned New York-based architecture and design studio, to find out how they embed well-being at the core of their spectacular projects. Karen and Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so very much for having us on the show. We're honored to be a part of it.
Well, we're delighted you're with us too. Now, before we begin, would you be able to give us a brief introduction into your backgrounds and the design vision of Span?
We'd be humbled to do so. I can say that Span Architecture is generally fascinated by the intersection of the natural world and the man-made. And we create spaces that we hope are extraordinary and feel reflective of a commitment to exploration of the reinvigoration of place. Our studio, I would say, is personable. We are grounded in a collective attitude, and we try to deliver responsible design that is thoughtful and elevated. Our moniker is we are curators, collectors, collaborators, and designers, and we try to be astute at collating diverse catalogs of inspiration for our clients who are equally inspirational and aspirational. Peter is here. He is currently a visiting lecturer at Princeton University and teaches at the Embodied Computation Lab, which examines the latest building technologies and systems, in addition to being a founder of our practice. And I have a passion, in addition to our firm, for public service and mentorship. I have just finished a 10-year term of being vice president on the executive board of a civic charity called Open House New York. And I am mentoring three young women who are entering the design profession.
Wow.
That's amazing. How do you find time to run your practice and do all that as well?
It's a bit of a juggling act.
It does sound like it. It sounds amazing. Just a little bit more about the business too. How big is your team?
We were a studio that kind of expands and contracts as we need to. We're typically around 15 people. It's a great size for a studio in the sense that Karen and I get to be involved directly with every project.
Can you just describe, Peter, some of the projects that you're currently working on?
So we just completed a renovation of Andy Warhol's old firehouse on the Upper East Side.
Oh, wow.
We have recently restored Mayor Harper's brownstone on Gramercy Park and restored it to a single family. It was kind of broken up into apartments for a couple of decades. We have a great variety of projects from hospitality to residential. So we feel very, very lucky.
Yeah, no, you've got some spectacular things on your website, that's for sure.
We're certainly incredibly humbled to mention that we've had one project prolifically published fairly recently called August Moon up in Maine. Peter and I, we work internationally and all throughout the United States. And it was a 15-year project in the making with five structures, and we're really proud of the exemplary, the example it gives of biophilia in architecture and design in general.
It is spectacular. Anyone listening, do go to the Span website and just have a look at that project because it's just off the charts. Wonderful. Anyway, I suppose we should get stuck in. So Karen, can you define for us well-being?
Yeah, absolutely. In the context of design, I would say well-being can be defined as creating a set of physical parameters that allow the inhabitant to experience living the way they want to best live. So we're designers who help people and groups realize their best physical reality. In that lies the state of well-being.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, well-being can be defined in several ways, I guess, depending on the context. To me, the simplest definition of well-being is perhaps that it's the point of equilibrium where one's environment and mental and physical states are kind of correspondingly balanced, right? I think equilibrium is really kind of a key point here.
That's fascinating.
How far would you say it's a set of constants, or does it vary between different individuals?
I guess it must be something essentially constant, right? I mean, there are certain basics that we all share, and yet we're all very different. We all require slightly different inputs to be able to feel well. So I'd say there are general conditions for wellness we share, and then very specific ones for each person. For example, some people like their bedrooms when they're too hot to cool them with a fan. An equal number of people are discomforted by a flow of air as they sleep, and it becomes kind of an irritant for them. So we can say that both conditions, the flowing air and no air, can produce a sense of wellness, despite the fact that they're completely the opposite of each other. So it really depends on the person. So environments really need to be designed to be flexible.
It's really important also to emphasize that while there are obviously constraints to design in general, design is not necessarily static. And I'd love to emphasize that well-being is as much about creating variety. And variety is inherently part of living well. So I would say that there are less constraints and more serendipity in great design for well-being.
I don't know, it sounds as though this sort of fine tailoring of environments for people, would you say that wellness is a first world construct?
I don't think so. I think most notions of wellness really are rooted in traditions. I mean, we can look back to, you know, yoga or meditation, and certainly even religion. These are things that are utilized by people all over the world to create mental and emotional spaces. And they're all precisely tapped into notions of wellness for people. I would say that safety is an essential quality of wellness, that one feels security and perhaps respite in the spaces they reside in. I think that's a somewhat foundational part of a sense of well-being.
Peter and I are often asked this question to some extent. A lot of our clients do have high net worth, but we have a very diverse client body. But I would say that in terms of the question you're asking about, is this a first world construct? It's the same logic used to say that money defines happiness. And of course, we all know that's not the case. Your child's smile will bring you a sense of well-being regardless of your wealth. Wellness, although many things, can be said to be the ability to find peace in your environment. And I think it can go without mention that modern sanitation, access to services, healthy food options, and housing alike will provide well-being much more easily. And while we have chosen our livelihood by having clients that actually pay us to undertake our work, it is always our hope, especially in the public spaces that we create, that every individual reaps the positive benefits of these spaces. And it's not a first world construct. It's for anyone who can access the spaces.
A universal construct.
Exactly.
Okay, so if well-being is different for everybody, how can designers get to the root of this when they're taking a brief from a client?
That's a great question. I mean, I think Karen and I both feel that there's a bit of a myth about briefs. I mean, clients often think they know exactly what they want when they spell out what they think they want. But I think in a productive design relationship, our clients often discover different paths. So the best client briefs for us are aspirational about, hey, live, how they live, and frankly, less prescriptive about how they want to achieve those ends from a spatial point of view. So obviously there are different ways to achieve the same goals, and it comes out of synthesizing what clients say with the spaces and environments that are possible. So it really is kind of marrying those two things up, and that becomes the kind of true nature of design. We often show multiple designs that kind of quote solve a client's brief, and our clients are often stunned that multiple solutions are possible to what they thought was a kind of singular problem.
I would agree with Peter, and Peter is very, very cerebral. I would say I'm more phenomenological. And I would often liken the idea that a brief is similar to the jewelry or the accessories that you bring to the little black dress, right? Our clients are generally really intelligent people, and they welcome the research, particularly when it comes to their homes and their own places. And they generally prioritize their domestic environments and their working environments to match up with the way they want to best live. They appreciate the dialogue and the collaborative nature that we bring to the process. It can be as simple as maximizing natural daylight, prioritizing interior air quality, and the human concerns for these issues transcend urban or rural typologies.
I suppose the minute detail, you know, does the client like to sleep with the bedroom window open or not? That's something that just evolves as the relationship evolves. You get to know more and more and more about the client as the design process proceeds.
We're life doctors as opposed to brain doctors.
I like that a lot. That's really clever. But if the design is for a public or a commercial space, because obviously at Span you have a foot firmly in both camps, how can the designer go about determining the wellness needs of a kind of a general target user?
The design process of our firm as it's evolved has been really interesting. Peter and I were both trained fairly classically in architecture and design, and have been led to believe and practice that good design is good for the environment, for your mental health and well-being, and the planet in general. But what's really interesting is that this word biophilia has permeated general culture more and more. And it's both really exciting and even a little bit disappointing that it hasn't come to the forefront even more quickly. Biophilia literally is a Greek word that means the love of living things and an attraction to nature and the relationship of living forms as it's imprinted onto the essence of being a human. And so I can add that in commercial and public spaces, good design, whether it be for commercial, residential, any design brief, a folly in a park comes back around to responsible biophilic design that takes your relationship to nature into account.
So the idea being that if that's embedded in the design, that actually the wellness needs of the target user almost automatically are taken care of.
Yeah, I mean, biophilia and wellness really do, it promotes and exemplifies a connection with place, designing with light, using patterns and shapes that are related to nature, utilizing natural materials and exploiting sensorial experiences of a site. These are all basic concepts of good design overall and in general.
Yeah, I think I totally agree. I mean, those are fundamental things that everybody needs and wants, access to light and air, connection to nature. We all want to feel safe, happy, and comfortable. And in the public realm, frankly, we would like to feel inspired. And I don't think we all agree on what that recipe is. I also like to think that a really, really good design should be provocative in some ways. I mean, one could argue that, you know, that some number less than 50% might not even like it. So I think the notion of a kind of target user is a bit of a kind of Hitchcockian MacGuffin. I don't think there is necessarily a target user. I think there's intelligent design and some folks will love it and understand it, and others understandably might not. But it ultimately is about finding a balance and creating spaces that really forge connections between people and nature.
What are the basic common human needs that designers need to consider? Are they ambient temperature, air quality, safe place to sleep, access to food?
These are important things that I think designers have been obsessed with. I mean, designers through the ages have thought about these issues to some extent. In my class, we talk about a cave as a kind of archetype, as a kind of defensible space, for instance. So again, this kind of spatial archetype for safety. designers have also tried to solve these issues through different systems as well. Le Corbusier, a French architect practicing in the mid-century, thought good proportions were the key to design with a system called modular. Certainly urban design has been obsessed with the same idea. In Olmsted in 1858 declared that parks are the lungs of the city. And he believed that parks and natural scenery offered relief from ordinary cares, change of air, it could promote change of habits and favorable health. So really, you know, and also pleasure, like, you know, that it, parks and space and nature can give pleasure for the time being and also increase capacity for happiness, right? So that's a pretty amazing possibility that architecture and design has that kind of possibility baked into it. And obviously this is something, this notion of public health is something we've all recently contemplated as we've lived through a few years of COVID. But, you know, we feel that design can really elevate these kind of, they're not quotidian, but these kind of necessities to something extraordinary.
How important are anthropometrics for health and well-being?
You know, it's absolutely critical when you consider the fact that our built environment is for humans. I mean, humans, although we have some difference in scale for every person compared to one another, in general, as a species, we're relatively closely sized. And so it would be irresponsible not to take anthropometrics into consideration. So I think it's definitely very important. And as Peter mentioned previously, proportions and the senses that a human has versus other species on our planet drive our reaction and our understanding of the environment that we experience around us, whether it be a natural environment or a constructed environment. So I suppose that's a long-winded way of saying yes.
But we also feel that, you know, one has to be careful about an overly deterministic set of rules in this instance. Otherwise, you wind up with designs like the zero gravity chair, which, you know, kind of purports to deal with certain ergonomic constraints, and you have this kind of, you know, abomination of a chair, frankly. But I think the best thing we can do as designers is to provide opportunities and spaces for healthful routines in people's lives. And like Susie, like you were saying, it's, you know, well-lit kitchen counters to prepare food, spaces for exercise, you know, spaces to grow food, you know, all these things do have kind of datums and kind of ergonomic considerations that were, you know, I think are important.
Obviously, providing for physical health is the easy part. But how do you go about improving mental health through your designs?
Again, it's, you know, it kind of comes to this kind of notion of kind of singularities in the sense that it's a process that we go through with every client. Once again, people are different. For instance, I like white walls. I like the way that they reflect daylight. I like that they reflect colors and the shadows of the exterior. I know clients that like dark natural wood surfaces, right? That's their kind of comfort zone. So again, we're all of different psychologies and kind of predilections. I mean, you know, I have cats and my cats make me very happy, and that's a predilection. My dog loving friends have the same feelings, but, you know, they don't want the cats. So flexibility is kind of the is key here. One needs to envision multiple futures when one designs, right? We have to imagine different types of people inhabiting spaces in different ways.
Within a family situation, you might have different people that have different preferences in terms of, you know, that can be quite difficult. If someone likes white and someone likes dark, how do you just divvy up the spaces, or, you know, how do you zone the project in some way so that people have a space of their own?
We really do believe that there are certain qualities of good design that permeate any functional need. And so I suppose making sure that all of the functional requirements are met in general for whomever we're designing is very important. But simultaneously, I think that the real gift that we can bring is making sure that we are then adding on to that and exposing people to those things that they haven't naturally said that they want to be able to do. You know, we'll provide the desk with the place with the pen and the paper and the computer to actually do your work, but simultaneously, what is the environment in which you're doing it? What are the natural lighting qualities? Is there a garden that's nearby that has water that you can hear, that you can hear the rustling of leaves on a tree, that you have a skylight over your head and you see rain clouds passing by? And continuing to, and even just making sure that even in a home where you're not necessarily having specifically natural elements integrated, having elements of just human contact and creating a rich and diverse experience of how you take a journey through a space. Once again, it's not a static process, and it's about making sure that there's enough level of comfort, but simultaneously challenged, so that you're mentally engaged in the space in which you're inhabiting.
How do the size of interior spaces impact both physical and mental wellness?
Well, as Karen mentioned, I think, you know, people thrive with variety, and some spaces can be quite small and work extremely well. I just read about a rental apartment in New York City near Astor Place that's about 2 meters wide and about perhaps like 3 meters long. And it's also very, very inexpensive and very, very sought after. So on one hand, the scale of that apartment is ridiculous in the sense that it's way too small. But on the other hand, it's proximate to an amazingly vibrant urban area in New York City. So, you know, there is that kind of opportunity for that larger connection to the kind of the urban world. So I would say that people thrive on variety. Ideally, I think having a combination of different types of spaces, different kind of volumes and kind of sectional qualities, you know, is ideal. But ultimately, I think it does come to variety, and we don't live inside all the time. So it's also about kind of connection to that exterior world.
In terms of interior spaces and the sizes, this is actually maybe in the opposite of what we've been talking about, something that can be much more specific to individuals. And so let's say in a residential environment, we would listen very, very carefully to try to decode where someone wants to be both stimulated and at rest in their home. And do they thrive in large, capacious, open air spaces, or do they need bay windows and smaller areas to be able to snuggle in and feel comfortable? And simultaneously with public spaces, we're very keen on making sure that we know there are so many different desires of how you want to inhabit and experience places. So we try to make sure that we create a variety within our public spaces that are being created.
How important is storage and decluttering?
I think decluttering is very important. I mean, clutter is a kind of spatial noise. We have some clients that are pile makers, kind of bordering on hoarders. Some people don't mind that. Other people don't want to see anything. I would say that one has to kind of chalk this up to predilection, but, you know, I do feel that, you know, the elimination of clutter is very, very important. And having a home for things so you know where things are is also comes down to really understanding how your client lives and operates.
We spend a lot of time with our clients talking about, you know, in general, you start with the broader aspects of what you're desiring to create, but you do spend a lot of time in the minutiae because the minutiae matters. It's the things that you're literally touching, feeling, experiencing. And I can add that I have yet to hear a client ever say that they want to live in a messy space. But we do really think that curation is incredibly important. And so one of the most important things when considering clutter per se is to define what clutter for someone is, because objects and the things that you surround yourself with can actually really bring you peace and harmony and evoke memories and not be cluttered at all. And it might just be that you haven't had the proper environment in which to house those things around you that you want to surround yourself with.
Location, I think, can have a huge impact on wellness too. You know, you go on holiday and you just feel wonderful. What is it about some places that just make you feel good?
Well, you know, it's funny. When one looks at places in terms of design, we're always thinking about locations can be wildly different. And as designers, we always want to kind of accentuate the positive. So the trick is to kind of find the latent advantages in specific places and unlock them. And again, that we try to map our clients' requests over these conditions. Like some people like waking up to a brightly lit eastern facing bedroom and they need the daylight to wake up. And some really don't want that. They would prefer a super dark room with no light at all. So again, it's this kind of matchmaking exercise. Views are amazing, but often we don't have great views. So it becomes a question of how designers can produce visual interest within the designs, right? There's this idea of a kind of interior landscape that has visual interest that is connected to great light and great air and things like that.
Why then is it important to foster this connection to nature in your view?
I'm very hopeful, as opposed to disturbed, that the idea of being connected to nature has come into vogue. It's been a fraction of time that human beings have actually had modern technology dictating and strongly influencing the way that we live our lives. And humanity, in large part, has coexisted with nature for much, much longer. So I would say, in fact, that being connected to nature is essential to being human and being inhabitants of this planet. You know, by definition, the notion of nature is it's not what's man-made, but in another really great context, the same word means it's inherent to the characteristics of something. And we find both of those definitions really relevant in our design work. It kind of comes back around also to the biophilic concept to promote experiences with a byproduct of wellness. And at the end of the day, I think we can both, Peter and I can both agree and do agree that designing well isn't good enough. It's important for humans to be connected to nature in their everyday lives, so that we can really appreciate how vital nature is to place. And frankly, what will be lost without the human to nature symbiotic relationship? It's really important to consider and experiment with the most optimal way to live on this planet and continue to thrive. This is our home.
As Peter pointed out though, not everyone unfortunately is able to live with a view of the ocean. How can designers introduce some of those benefits of location when they're designing in less fortunate places?
We've been very lucky in the sense that we also, in addition to doing kind of residential work for individual clients, we also do multifamily work. And we recently completed a project called Gotham West, which is in a well-known, very undesirable, formerly undesirable part of New York called Hell's Kitchen. And we really tried to create an oasis that was of three residential towers and two schools in a full city block. And the way we did that was to create a kind of interior green space, a garden that was kind of surrounded by these kind of built environments. But every apartment, every amenity space had a view and a kind of connection to that garden and to that green space. So, you know, you could think of it as kind of a cloister in the middle of a very kind of urban environment. We've kind of been able to form this oasis on the inside of it. And I think that's a strategy that is applicable, you know, anywhere, in the sense that, you know, it doesn't require tons of money and expensive materials. It really just kind of requires some intelligence and sensitivity to that need, to that basic, desire for connection to nature.
If there isn't a landscape to experience, we create an interior landscape.
Mm-hmm. And just if you're creating an artificial interior landscape, does that work as effectively as a real one? Are the two equivalent?
It's a real garden. I mean, there's real kind of plants. There's a vegetable garden. There's, you know, trees, and it's not a totally kind of artificial space.
But what if you were designing in a place where you didn't have that opportunity? Are there ways that you could manage that and introduce some of these biophilic elements in an artificial sense that would have as much benefit for the users as the real thing?
You know, one of the interesting things also about the project Peter mentioned, Gotham West, is that we did have the opportunity to create literally a natural environment, this indoor, beautiful courtyard that the three towers looked upon. But in addition to that, if you're traveling through the mountains, if you're at the ocean side, your connection to nature is incredibly obvious. One of our human needs is also our desire to understand and engage with our surroundings and you know, contemplate why they bring us joy, peace, excitement, inspiration. And so, for example, in addition to the garden space in this residential complex, we also created a whole other slew of amenities. There is a large commercial kitchen where any of the people who live in the complex can enjoy, cook together, share a meal. There's a gallery space that is lit by natural daylight. So it does have a connection to the exterior, but really it's about enhancing your experience of the culture, the vibrant culture of living in an urban environment. And this gallery, they've chosen to predominantly feature local artists that are up and coming and, you know, really challenging what it is to make and create art. So I would say that you need to consider where you're designing and what you can promote within that particular place to best inspire the people who are enjoying that area, that location.
Yeah, I think the idea that sometimes we have to make locations, right? There's no location there. So one has to kind of imagine ways to forge connectivity between people and those types of interactions and, you know, to make kind of interior places that have natural materials and, you know, just the ability to kind of interact with our kind of fellow humans.
You know, I won't expound upon this too much, but I mean, you're making me think, Susie, about, what's going to happen when we as humans finally do reach Mars? Or people are living on the moon. And to say that there is nothing biophilic per se, or would we have to create an environment? Yeah, of course we would create an environment that would bring us comfort, but simultaneously, if we're really going to embrace other places, other experiences to the best of our abilities, we're going to look at those places and tease out what's really, really special about being there as opposed to always being here.
So I'm just thinking about, you know, clever use of things like soundscapes. You know, I know they've introduced them into urban environments where you'd be walking along and you might hear, you know, birds tweeting and things like that. And there's artificial ways to perhaps bring in biophilic elements that I'm not entirely convinced. I think your approach, Peter, sounds more embedded in a way, because you're making the best of each situation. And I think, Karen, you just summed it up really well with the example of life on Mars, rather than trying to intervision. You know, it's not enough to just have pictures of nature, or is it? Do we, you know, because I think a lot of interior designers misunderstand biophilia a little bit. They think that just by, you know, introducing a few green colors and a couple of houseplants, they've nailed it.
Yeah, that's completely true. I think it goes much, much further to that. It's you know, introduction of pattern. It's kind of you know, connection to those kind of systems and geometries that we see in nature.
And it's inherent. It's literally inherent in being human. And as mentioned previously, modern technology, waking up to an alarm clock, not paying attention to our circadian rhythms and the like, is really taken a very, it's a tiny little piece of our entire evolution as humans on this planet.
What about technology? Does technology have a part to play in wellness?
It certainly does, I think. I mean, technology is the possibility, I think, of becoming increasingly invisible in some ways, in a good way. I can ask about the weather, for example, and a digital assistant can immediately assist. And that's such a fundamental simplification of how one used to understand weather. And that version of technology supplies and simplifies information. And that's wonderful because it creates a surplus of time, which in turn means we can do other things like go for a run without fear that we will be stormed upon. Of course, the opposite and more worrisome side of technology really resides in, frankly, the corporations that have become gatekeepers that control and create information and frankly define the limits of our privacy. I mean, that's the kind of, the other side that we need to be obviously very mindful of.
We are always constantly looking at ways to incorporate the latest technologies, sustainable materials, healthy materials into what we build. And I think just as a responsible and good designer, it's a requirement to stay on top of technological advances as they can provide the best possible outcome of what you're creating.
You kind of imply that there may be good tech and bad tech, but sometimes is there also too much tech? When I was pulling the questions together for this podcast, we were talking about it, my team at my office, and we were using the example of lighting control systems and actually the pleasure that can be had from turning on table lamps. The idea that you come into a space and you move around the room turning on your lamps. It's part of your whole kind of winding down at the end of the day. You're coming home and you're lighting the lamps. And lighting the lamps, lighting the fire, surely is a it's an atavistic thing that must go back into, millennia, where people, came home to the comfort of warmth and fire.
I feel like I can answer that question in so many different ways. And having been through, and maybe I guess we're still in a pandemic, I won't even go there, but having experienced having to live in a very, very different way. And then in addition to that, having our family in our studio and helping our studio navigate living in a different way has really forced us to reevaluate what we surround ourselves with and how we live in our environments. When everyone had to basically retreat back to their homes and suddenly your one environment was your everything environment, you really did take a pretty close look at, what is my work life? What is my cultural life? What is my home, family, and friend life? And how do I define those in different ways? And in some respects, it would be, as you were mentioning, changing your environment very simply by saying, well, in the morning when I'm getting ready for work, I turn on the light at my desk. And at night, I turn it off and I might light the fire. But the other thing too is also being stuck in one space and being forced to experience all the things around you that you might not have been aware of. For example, in the morning, the birds start calling. And did you ever actually hear them and realize that they were waking you up on equal measure? Maybe you didn't really need your alarm clock as much as you thought you did. Or at night, you actually do naturally become more sleepy, or at least some people do. I'm a night owl, but most people become more sleepy when the sun goes down, and taking a bit of a slowness approach to the world.
I think technology also lets us re-examine how we live to some degree. I mean, unfortunately, all of us got to, live through the Zoom universe during COVID, where most of our interactions with other people were, via our laptops and a bunch of kind of talking heads on a screen. But what has come of that is it's made people realize that they can function that way, that technology can be enabling and can provide for flexibility. So I think what we're seeing is a real interest in people not having to go to the workplace all the time, that they can be productive in different environments. And perhaps that's even necessary. So we've had this kind of unintended consequence from COVID, let's say, that people have this kind of understanding that some technology can be liberating. We all cringe a little bit when we see our children staring at their phones for hours. So again, it really kind of, it comes down to understanding what's valuable in technology. When our phone can tell us our resting heart rate, for example, or how far did I walk today, or technology is valuable when utilized purposefully.
And it can enslave you when it's not.
Absolutely.
So ultimately, of course, none of us can be well if the planet we live on is not. How much is sustainability a factor in your projects?
Designers everywhere are beginning to realize the fundamental connection to nature that modern design has in many ways neglected at the expense of our health and the health of our planet. While working at vastly different scales, our studio has a reverence for superlative design work, and we can see the inherent beauty and qualities that make a place, you know, not just a space, are increasingly popular. Or a recently popular biophilic approach facilitates the notion that every place does not need to be everything, but rather needs to respond to our client partner's goals and breathe the life of that place, right? So biophilic design, although it is currently trendy, may in fact be the only path forward in our future on this planet.
Yeah, I mean, design ultimately is a big contributor to our planet's problems. I mean, the constructed world has contributed, you know, unmeasurable amounts of CO2. And it's time that that is reined in. It's something that's really, thankfully, is now being studied. And, you know, it is in schools, something that students consider very seriously, that they've been handed this kind of problem that requires kind of authentic stewardship for a responsible design.
We're at a real crossroads in our time on Earth, and our consideration of the future that we want to have and that we want to give to the future of humanity, you know, lays in the balance of the decisions we're making today and what we're going to choose to construct and how we're going to choose to construct it.
I get the sense that you guys are way ahead of the curve. Has biophilia always been embedded in your design philosophy?
It absolutely has been. And I was just so astounded to learn the term biophilia. And I thought, oh, that's what we do. Biophilia actually came about, I don't know if the audience knows this, as a scientific concept, not a design concept at all. And maybe I can look this up at some point, but there was a famous scientific experiment that happened. And I want to say it was in a zoo. When zoos first became popular, animals were placed into really inhospitable environments, and they did not thrive. Pandas, for example, will not mate in any other environment except in their bamboo fields in China. And some researchers and scientists started saying, how can we help our neighbors on this planet live a better life and yet simultaneously be able to share the experience of nature even more broadly by bringing them into civic environments? And so what happened, which seems so obvious to us today, is that a chimpanzee cage was suddenly made into the environment in which that animal would reside in nature. Now, a lot of people are going to have problems with the concept of zoos in general, and I can go on and on about that too, but it does really come back around to the fact that suddenly this phrase, this idea of biophilia, the love of life, and how do you embrace and codify and exemplify your ability to love life happen as designers? It's the gift that we have to give.
I can confirm for our audience that Karen is 100% spot on. A psychologist working at Seattle Zoo in the early 1990s began to rethink the enclosures for primates.
There you go, Seattle, yeah.
Amazing.
Okay, so in the same way that people talk about greenwashing when they're talking about sustainability being manufactured by certain brands to make the brands look better than they are, is there an equivalent well-washing?
No, that's a very, very valid question. I mean, like many things, there's kind of good advice and bad advice, and there is, let's say, information and misinformation. I would say in general, we have a very positive attitude at our practice and hope that our genuine interest in wellness shines through in our work and frankly influences the work that others pursue and the other lives that we've, you know, touched through our work. It's about finding authentic information and authentic processes that can be embedded in good practice and in good design and to kind of weed out the patently incorrect information.
Thanks so much, Karen and Peter, for your time today. That was just inspirational. So much to take away from our conversation.
We're so honored to be part of this podcast. And when Peter and I were brainstorming and preparing about this, we actually went back to our roots, to one of our very, very first projects and said, you know, if we were to tell a story about our approach to wellness and design, what would be the simplest story that we might tell? And if we have a moment, I can share that with you.
We would love that, Karen. Thank you.
One of our very, very first projects, we were a firm of three at the time, and this is quite some time ago, was for a couple that lived in the city. They had a small one-bedroom apartment. They also were fortunate enough to have a place to get outside the city. And they bought into a tower on the Hudson River in New York. And it had beautiful views of the river, expansive views towards the New Jersey coast, and open and vast sky. But the actual environment was actually quite depressing. The ceilings were low, the layout was incredibly generic. And one of the most unfortunate things is that because a lot of these layouts kind of happen in a backwards way and sometimes are more about square footage than about experience, when you walked in, you walked right in on the corner of a wall. So when we met with these clients, we began talking to them about their needs. And in fact, the apartment pretty much provided for everything they needed. They had a kitchen, they had a bathroom, they had a bedroom. And one of the clients actually in jest said, you know, not only do I not want this apartment to feel like every other apartment, I really just wish we could get rid of all of the hard corners. Wouldn't it be really great if our apartment was the one that flowed and was softer and really a foil to what these generic high-rise apartment buildings are like? And so Peter and I had already done a photo essay on what now is known as biophilia. I had obsessively taken many photographs of the water since that was the primary view, and cataloging how the water would change with not just the weather, but the boat traffic, migration of birds, cloud structures and the like. And we said, you know what, let's not have any hard corners. Can we do that? I mean, Corbusier had a lot of curves. We can aspire to this. Let's go for it. So we actually took the primary bifurcating wall in the unit that separated the bedroom and private spaces, bathroom and the like, from the kitchen, living room, great room, and we deconstructed it and reconstructed it with a series of curving walls that folded over on one another and overlapped. And were we had to recreate the entry area and decided that we would fold back, peel back the walls and create an entry table within the fold of these two spaces. And hopefully I'm explaining this well enough so that everyone can kind of get a visual in their mind's eye. So within this folded space, there was the opportunity to create some kind of a lighting move or something else to really enhance the fact that we have these curving wall structures. So we placed in there, inspired by all the photographs of the water, a panel of modeled glass. And what this modeled glass does is that it is, it acts as an opaque barrier between the bedroom spaces and the public spaces, but simultaneously the light from the windows, the natural lighting, will actually cast shadows on either side of this panel onto these gently curving walls that mimic and play upon the beautiful texture and shadows and bright lights that you would get off of the water that you would naturally see. And so you can have that happen during the day. It changes depending on the weather, the clouds, the wind, but also at night they could illuminate this, this panel as well. And it became a major feature, but a soft feature. So kind of coming around full circle in the story, that's what we created. Well, how does this come back around to wellness? So at the end of the project, being one of our very first projects, our clients threw a party and they wanted to introduce their friends to their new home. They're really excited about it. And we actually made an apartment for them with curves. And so they invited us to come to the party and they said, you have to come to the party. This is what you helped create with us in collaboration. So we did, and they introduced us and they literally articulated that they're very thankful to have not just the functional needs of their home created for them, but to have their aspirational goals achieved. And it gave them, it really truly gave them a home, not just a place to reside or to function in their city lives. And they toasted us and thanked us for the gift that we were able to give to them, in large part in collaboration. They were our inspiration. We couldn't have done it without them. I cried a little tear. It was an incredible moment. And you know, everyone actually even clapped. And you know, from then on, Peter and I said, you know, this is really what it's all about. It's about forming these relationships and these bonds with our clients and creating something together that we couldn't create alone without them. It's the partnership. And in essence, it's well-being. It's living the life, the best life you wanna live.
Fantastic insights into the world of wellness design, which we're sure will be warmly welcomed by our audience. We do hope you've enjoyed this episode, and please do get in touch on our social channels to share any feedback. We're on Instagram and Facebook at Interior Design Business Pod. The Interior Design Business is a Wildwood production.